Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Exploring Current Patterns of Care in the Community, Selection of First-Line and Maintenance Therapy for Patients with Extensive Stage Small Cell Lung Cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Haas Borghai from the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia, and Dr. Ann Chang from the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven. Today, we're here to talk about extensive stage small cell. And as in all of our meetings, we will be discussing the use of unapproved agents and regimens. So check out the package inserts for more information. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out with a little bit of an introduction, talking about the whole concept of goals of treatment of extensive stage disease. Then we'll get into current considerations in these decisions. Haas is going to do a presentation, present a couple cases. Then we're going to show you some of the survey results from 50 general medical oncologists that we surveyed over the last couple weeks. And then we'll come back and Ann will do a presentation on what to look for in the future, ongoing trials, and also present a couple of patients. And as I mentioned, we just did this survey on 50 community-based general medical oncologists, and we'll share the results as we go along. But I just want to take a breath and talk about something we actually talked about in the first webinar in this series, and that is something that comes up all the time when meeting with a patient with cancer who's going to be treated, which is what are the goals of treatment? And I just kind of came into my consciousness over the last few months in the first webinar I was mentioning that we had done this program in November for the AON group, American Oncology Network. We did a module on lung cancer with several noted investigators. But Dr. Langer presented some data, and I was like, wow, I haven't seen that before, talking about five-year survival of extensive stage small cell, showing there's a tail on the curves of these IO studies that we've been looking at for a while. It looks like maybe around 10, 12, maybe even 15%. I was like, wow, because, you know, we're talking about maintenance, quality of life. Do we want to make people give them more toxicity? It's very different if you have, if you have cure as a possible outcome, even if it's not that common. So we asked in this webinar, we asked our two faculty, do you see patients who are coming at 5 years and still doing well? They both said yes, and again, and gave us that same number, and did a great review article in JAMA. I really recommend it to you. Unfortunately, every time you write a review article, the next day there's a new paper out. So I think you were perfect timing, Ann, because it was right before the ASCO meeting when the Inforte trial was coming. So I guess you have to rewrite your paper. But anyhow, it's a great paper in there. But again, you see there in Ann's paper, five-year overall survival, 12%, which really kind of resonated with me. So we asked these oncologists, these 50 oncologists, what are you saying to your patients? Extensive stage disease. They ask you, what's the chance that I'm going to be alive in 5 years and doing well? And you can see that in general, they're kind of getting the message. We ask about cure, more difficult challenge, and they say they're seeing that as well. So I just wanted to get a little bit of a flair, really, of what you're saying to your patients. And I'll start out with you, Ann. First of all, what's your experience? You just shared with me, actually, you just submitted an abstract to ASCO about this topic, which I didn't even know about. But what do we know about these patients?
Yeah, I think that there is a tail to the curve. We just looked at our experience at Yale, and we had 15 patients that were beyond 1 year. And of those, a third of them were beyond 5 years. So I do think that there is a subset of patients that does respond to immunotherapy. I think it's immunotherapy. We didn't see this kind of effect prior to immunotherapy. And I think that's why people are really interested in, you know, how can we augment that? Can we prevent resistance to MHC1 antigen presentation? And how can we do better by our patients and get that effect for more?
So, Haas, any thoughts about that? Again, I'm curious if patients ask you or bring this up, how you respond. Any ways to predict who's going to be around in 5 years? I hear people asking about cell-free DNA. Does that have any role, in these patients? Have you had patients on checkpoint inhibitors for several years? What's your experience, Haas?
So my experience is also very similar to Anne in that we definitely have patients who are on maintenance immunotherapy for quite some time without evidence of disease recurrence. So they are technically on active treatment, but on a single agent maintenance IO and with good disease control. So I'm very happy to see that. So I can tell you that I think we are replicating what we are seeing in the clinical trials. Now, I don't have the exact numbers from my center, so I can't promise you that it is 12 to 15%, but we're definitely close to it. Unfortunately, we have not been able to develop a biomarker or a selection criteria to decide who is going to have that prolonged survival and better survival. And it is something that a number of groups, including Dr. Chang's group at Yale, has been working on to try to help us identify who are the patients who have a better chance of having this long-term benefit. You know, the cell-free DNA and other plasma blood-based assays are very popular, but I think at this point they're all considered to be investigational as opposed to ready for prime time and being incorporated into clinical practice. But the hope is that in the next 3 to 5 years, we will have additional tools to help us select patients who would most benefit from these kinds of approaches.
Just really an amazing clinical situation. It's hard to think of another situation in oncology where the median survival of the total group is what, about 13 months, devastating disease. And yet here you have these patients who have this long-term benefit. It, to me, it just colors also how aggressive you are in taking care of pain. We don't want to, if you know for sure there's no chance of cure, then palliation is much higher up on your, but now you got to take into consideration, I think, you know, this issue. I'm just curious if anybody in the chat room has seen patients that actually, I got an email from a doc, Dr. Khatri, Jamil Khatri. I didn't know where there's a Newark, Delaware, as well as Newark, New Jersey. But anyhow, this is where the University of Delaware is, I found out. So he was saying, he actually brought up this issue. He said he's seeing patients who are making it 5 years, and he wants to know about, you know, whether or not if you, they're still in treatment. I mean, I don't know if you'd keep treatment going for 5 years. And are you generally using indefinite treatment in patients, or do you stop after a couple years? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the initial trials were until progression or toxicity. I've had really good luck with these patients that continuing therapy. I mean, typically, I had one patient who is on, for example, atezo for 3 years, and then we finally stopped it because she had COVID and had some other issues, and she's been out another 2 years and has done well. I think that if they've tolerated the therapy for that long, it's really hard to stop, especially if they're doing well.
So I want to thank Dr. Khatri. He tells me that he actually started listening to our stuff when we were doing cassette tapes where you had to rewind it, and now he says he spends about an hour every night watching our videos after he gets into bed at night. I guess it may be soporific. I don't know. But anyhow, all right, let's get into some data here. And of course, you know, we saw the Inforte study last year at ASCO and very quick FDA approval. Haas, can you talk a little bit about what we know right now about first line maintenance therapy?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So this is where the standard of care has been, right? We've had two studies, large randomized global studies in Power 133 and Caspian with different checkpoint inhibitors added to the platinum etoposide backbone. And they both have shown a median survival around 12 to 13 months, as we have talked about. So this was the initial presentation. And almost overnight, the practice changed and we all started incorporating the checkpoint inhibitors into our everyday practice. The good thing about this was that the IO was added with the first cycle of the chemotherapy. And these are some of the long-term survival data that we've been able to generate. And as you were just referring to, if you see on the graph, there's definitely a curve, a tail to this survival curve. Again, it's unfortunately not a large patient population. We're talking about 12 to 15%. Nonetheless, as was pointed out by Anne and you, this is not something we used to see in the chemotherapy era. So this is wonderful to sort of have. However, I think our question has been, who are are the patients who are at the tail of the curve and how can we improve this? And some of the areas that, you know, we're not going to discuss necessarily tonight, like the subtypes of lung cancer or small cell lung cancer might have something to do with this, but I think that's a future sort of discussion. There have been other positive studies, and these are just to be fair and balanced in the context of this program. We wanted to present this. And, you know, what hasn't worked is, you know, I think that additional checkpoint inhibitors like TIGIT, unfortunately, has not been a positive here. And I think this is something that we have to bear in mind, that much like non-small cell lung cancer, we do have a little bit of an issue in terms of advancing this beyond what we have achieved. You refer to the IMforte study. Just to be, again, transparent, I'm one of the co-investigators on the study. So we had the trial open at our center, and I'm one of the co-authors on the publications and abstracts. This was a simple study, four cycles of induction chemo plus a checkpoint inhibitor, in this case, atezo, and patients who were not progressing were then randomized to standard of care continuation of atezo versus atezo with lorbenectadine at standard doses added to the regimen. So the clock sort of starts after the induction phase of the treatment. So what is lorbenectadine? So lorbenectadine was introduced, you know, a few years ago to our standard practice. We know that it has approval to be used in sort of second, third line setting. It is a drug that works by inhibiting transcription in the tumors. And the scheme here, the schema here shows what we believe to be the mechanism of action of this drug, inhibiting transcription factors. But also there's some early studies suggesting that it actually could have an immunomodulatory effect. So the rationale for combination of a checkpoint inhibitor plus lorbenectadine was exactly that. The drug is active against small cell, so we get that sort of a cytotoxic effect, but at the same time, we seem to have immunomodulatory effects. So what happens if we bring these two together and sort of see what the outcome is? This is from the study that led to the approval of lorbenectadine in the small cell, just to show everybody that the drug by itself does have clinical efficacy in small cell, more so in patients with chemosensitive disease, nonetheless a fairly good and well-tolerated drug in this setting. So what did IMforte show? It actually showed that both progression-free survival and overall survival in the analysis was in favor of using the sort of maintenance LORB plus atezolizumab, as shown by the blue curves on both of these curves. So on the left-hand side, we have the PFS curve, and you can see the blue line on top is the combination as opposed to the standard of care. And then on the right-hand side, we have the overall survival. What I want everybody to pay attention to is that, again, both the PFS and OS are from the time of randomization to LORB, so after four cycles of induction chemo had been given. And you see that the median survival here is definitely improved as opposed to single agent IO. So whatever we get with the induction, you add additional time gained by the addition of lorbenectadine in the maintenance setting. So this is, as you pointed out, the results that led to the approval of the combination in the maintenance setting. Subgroup analysis all favored the use of the combination. And then the main issue is, you know, what are we getting in terms of the response rate? Keep in mind that these patients have already had four cycles of induction. So the majority of responses were seen in the initial phase of it. This was not part of the study. But nonetheless, you see that we still have an additional 10 to 20% of patients having more responses, 20% when they get the LORB combination, and about 10% with the atezo. And the cost of it is some of the additional toxicity we get with lorbenectadine. None of the toxicities were a surprise, so we did not see additional side effects that were unknown, but myelosuppression and some of the other GI symptoms were more common with the addition of lorbenectadine. Overall, patients on the study were able to go and continue and get additional treatment. But one issue with the study was that only a few patients, around 9%, were able to get LORB on the control arm of the trial. So that is something that I think we need to rectify in future studies. So overall, I think this result has what prompted the approval of the combination in the maintenance setting for patients with extensive stage small cell.
So we'll get into sort of what this means in terms of clinical practice when we get to the survey. You know, it's interesting getting back to our initial discussion here when we were showing the old IO studies. I remember when I first saw it there, I was thinking, ah, it's not so impressive. You know, do we really need to give it? I noticed though that it was actually only 1 month difference in overall survival. But again, there's that tail out there that's so very intriguing. And quick question from the chat room from Hassan about transformed prostate cancer to small cell. How do you approach those patients? I don't know if you treat them or hear about them or if you have any thoughts about that. But particularly he wants to know about the role of tarlatamab and I guess IOs as well.
I don't treat well, I'll say this. Because I have been involved in establishing our bispecific and tarlatamab program here, I have seen some of those patients with transformed small cell in prostate neuroendocrine, bladder. There are also some other extrapulmonary neuroendocrine tumor types. And so they actually do respond to tarlatamab, and actually you can request DLL3 staining for that. So we actually have a case study that is going out this week describing that. So yes, typically the small cell regimens are what extrapulmonary small cell folks also use, and so that includes the platinum etoposide doublet with IO initially, with immunotherapy initially, and the use of tarlatamab.
Interesting. All right, let's get back to small cell of the lung. And we have a couple of cases here from Haas, starting out with your 60-year-old woman. What happened with her?
Right. So this is a very typical case, as I would call it, for patients with the diagnosis of extensive stage small cell. A little bit younger than the normal age for small cell, but 60-year-old, 35-pack year smoking history, has a couple of months of progressive shortness of breath, cough, wheezing. She ends up being treated with antibiotic and steroids. These are some of the background emphysema, COPD. But then eventually, because she wasn't getting better, she ends up having a CT that shows a pretty significant disease involving, you see the pictures, you have the mediastinum, involvement of the some of the pulmonary vasculature, liver metastases, and unfortunately, I think she also had an adrenal gland that was involved. So the bronchial biopsy shows small cell lung cancer. Liver biopsy confirms that this is metastatic small cell. Brain MRI was negative, so she went on to receive carboplatin, etoposide, and atezolizumab. We selected to give her GCSF as prophylaxis from cycle one just because some of the symptoms that she had. She had actually experienced weight loss, and the cough and the shortness of breath was quite bothersome for her. What we learned during the chemo, and now you're seeing pre-treatment and post-treatment as expected, as it is for this disease, very chemosensitive, 60-70% response rate to standard treatment. Her symptoms improved quite significantly with the first couple of cycles of the treatment. Weight loss stabilized, and she was able to become a lot more functional. But she had myelosuppression. She had anemia, required blood transfusions. Despite the use of growth factor, she had some neutropenia. So when it came time to do the maintenance treatment, we decided to not to introduce lorbrenectedin right from the get-go. Although I had talked to her prior to initiation of maintenance that there's a possibility of adding another treatment. But then once she recovered, we went ahead and added that lorbrenectedin as we just reviewed per the M40 study. So it was added from cycle two of atezo, and she has been continuing on that. So she has had a total of three additional cycles with LORB. CAT scans are still showing stable disease. So to me, this is an example of someone we followed the clinical trial data, and so far it's been successful, and we'll continue to monitor her.
So before I ask Anne if she has any thoughts about this case, I'm curious about the discussion you had with her about the possibility of adding LURB in maintenance therapy. What was her global sort of approach to this? Was she more concerned about toxicity, efficacy? Was she hoping that maybe she'd be in the five-year group?
So honestly, I did not talk to her about the five-year group. I think we did discuss that there is a possibility of continuing maintenance as long as the disease is responding and she's tolerating it. But I did not introduce the idea of the possibility of five-year survival simply because I have no way of knowing ahead of time how to select patients like that. But I did decide to talk to her about maintenance with the addition of LURB because I would like my patients to be a little bit better prepared from a frame of mind type of discussion that there could be additional treatment that could introduce toxicities very similar to some of the toxicities we were experiencing with platinum and with the chemotherapy. And I think this way, when I start early and I go back to it every time I see the patient, the questions that come up every week are becoming a little bit more refined from the patient perspective, what kind of toxicities, how long I'm going to do it. So it allows the patient and the family to adjust to the idea of having yet another drug added and what the potential side effects are. So from that perspective, I thought she was actually pretty well prepared. She was actually a little bit upset when she came for the first cycle of Atezo, and I told her that I wasn't going to add the LURB just because she was so fatigued and I thought she needed more time to recover. But since then, she has had the expected adverse events. We are in contact with her, obviously, and managing some of that. So it's a little bit of managing some of the expectations from the toxicities and the efficacy. She was very worried about the side effects, but she was also pleased to hear that there was the potential for additional survival advantage with the addition of LURB. So I think she agreed to it from the point of view that, you know, she's 60 years old, relatively young, and wanted to have as much opportunity as possible to sort of battle this disease. So that's how we approached the discussion with her.
So in addition to showing you kind of how people treat patients, in this survey, we also asked people, are there any questions you'd like us to ask the faculty? And I don't have to tell you the most common question. I thought it was interesting the way most people framed it as, who are the patients you don't give LURB to? But as you were listening to Haas present this case, in your mind, were you thinking, this is the kind of patient's going to end up on a LURB as well as an IO?
I was on the fence, and I think what impressed me about that study was, number one, the attrition rate. So the number of patients that started induction and then about 25% either didn't have the performance status 0-1 or didn't have the response to be randomized to the maintenance. And so for this patient, if she had fatigue, wasn't feeling very well, and needed more time for recovery, I could see that she might have been somebody where, if she was maybe, 20 years older, also a little more frail, where I would have said, I think let's just give you a chance to recover. There's potentially still benefit. We still have lurbinectedin that we can use in second line if we need it, but you need to get a little bit stronger first. So I think for this patient who's 60 and who wants to be as aggressive as possible, and it's, she had some fatigue, but probably still had the performance status. I think this was the right way to go.
I think I have to add, I don't think everybody who comes into the clinic is a candidate for LURB. That's not what I'm arguing for at all. I think you do have to use the clinical trial data to guide your treatment. And then you have to use your expertise, your feel for the patient and what you have seen in this disease to decide who is a candidate. There's definitely additional toxicities involved. And I'm not by any means advocating that everybody should get LURB in the maintenance setting. It definitely is not the case. But in somebody who's recovered, and I agree with Anne, I think this patient might have a hard time enrolling in the study because she was so fatigued. She probably would not have been able to go on the study if we were, really considering her for the IMforte back then. But again, knowing that, with the tincture of time a little bit, some of these patients do recover, I thought it was reasonable to reintroduce the idea. But by all means, you have to evaluate these patients on a case-by-case basis to decide if they can handle additional treatment in this disease.
Yeah, I was going to say you had me at 60 years old when you started the write-up. That to me is a pretty strong red flag that you're going to at least be thinking about it. This seems like even more complicated, Haas, a 64-year-old lady. What happened with her? A lot more comorbidity issues.
She does. She does have a lot more comorbidity. So again, she had quit smoking about 13 months prior to diagnosis, but she had a 40-pack year history of smoking. Unfortunately, she was diagnosed with metastatic small cell, and she had a positive QuantiFERON gold test at the time of diagnosis. She was under the care of a pulmonologist by then, and given the small cell diagnosis, there was no question that we needed to proceed with the treatment. So she was seen by pulmonary, by ID, to manage the this latent TB that we sort of determined she had. She also has a history of coronary artery disease, heart failure, COPD, and a moderate to severe obstruction based on her PFTs. However, despite all of that, she has a reasonable performance status. I think many of you have heard Dr. Langer, who was one of my mentors, saying if the patient can get up from the chair, go to the table for exam, that's a good sign. She was able to do that. And when we asked her how much she can do, she walked 10 blocks without having to stop, goes up the steps. So she's doing all of her own ADL. So despite the comorbidity, she had a fairly good performance status. This is the disease that we were that we're dealing with. So from a small cell point of view, if you look at the nose, they're not as bulky as the first case that we saw. But definitely she had more disease, including, unfortunately, brain metastases at the time of initial diagnosis. We consulted our radiation oncologist. We agreed to follow her because she was asymptomatic. And here we started her with, again, carbo, etoposide, and the atezolizumab. And I added trilaciclib to this because of the fact that I was, given her comorbidities, was a little bit more concerned about her tolerability of chemo and potential for myelosuppression. And I'm pleasantly surprised and happy to say that she tolerated the treatment very well. These are the post-induction treatments, as you see. We also have intracranial response in this. So again, one of these newer way of looking at brain metastases in small cell. If there's asymptomatic and they're small, you can follow the patients with reasonable confidence that there might be treatment. So she actually went on to receive Lorbi in the maintenance, but after the first dose of Lorbi plus atezo, she ended up in the emergency room with hypertension, palpitation. She was admitted, did a full cardiac workup. We couldn't find any etiology. Lorbi was held for cycle 2, but added for cycle 3. Again, after cycle 3, she went back to the emergency room with very similar symptoms. Again, admitted for 24 hours, 48 hours. Workup was done, and we decided to hold Lorbi for cycles 4 and 5, and no ER visits happened. So quite frankly, I thought she was having a reaction to Lorbi that had not been well described, and I couldn't identify it. I couldn't explain it. But in sort of a shared decision-making process, we decided not to reintroduce Lorbi because two ER visits back-to-back after exposure was enough for me to be nervous about it. So she has remained on maintenance atezo. Unfortunately, she does have evidence of progression in the brain, and she required SRS. But other than that, she is continuing with the atezo for now with close monitoring of her brain in conjunction with our radiation oncology group.
So a couple questions back to Anne. I'm curious, have you seen responses in the brain as occurred in this patient to systemic therapy? It kind of reminds me of EGFR and ALK, you know, see response to systemic therapy. And also, have you seen anything like what happened with this patient with the cardiovascular hypertension reaction?
So I will point out that, you know, we know with the NCCN guidelines that if you have asymptomatic brain mets with chemo IO, it's absolutely okay to start with systemic treatment. And we do know that that crosses the blood-brain barrier and can be quite effective. I also point out that before the IMforte trial, they actually did not allow any patients with brain mets. And that was a decision that was made, I think, partially because this is a large molecule and may not cross the blood-brain barrier. So I always take that into consideration, although I think lurbinectedin is a great drug. In the second line, I've used it a lot with patients with brain mets. And in my experience, they've tolerated tolerated quite well. So I have not seen what you describe, Haas, but I totally agree with you that you know, two back-to-back ER visits is would be in my book the same thing. I would just, you know, say let's go on with the immunotherapy. And these mm-hmm. patients you definitely have to monitor with the every 3 month brain MRI because they are at risk for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm going to go on now in a second and talk about the clinician survey results, but also, you know, as part of the survey, we asked the docs to present a case. So I had 50 cases to deal with. We also asked any questions you'd like to ask the faculty. I already mentioned one, but I just want to quickly go through one case and see, Haas, how you, your response. 65-year-old woman, extensive stage disease, history of COPD, gets Durva, Carbo, Etoposide, and Durva, Lurbi maintenance, which is one question I have for you. We asked the question here, but so this patient got the Lurbi with Durva, has a CR, remains in CR, has been on maintenance for 3 months. The doc wants to know, how long do you continue both or either drugs, and also any role for MRD testing?
So the question number one, Durva versus Atezo. So from a clinical point of view, I don't differentiate between the checkpoint inhibitors that much. So from my point of view, I don't really care what IO you start with. And as long as you don't have any other issues with the combination, I think it's perfectly reasonable to want to add the lurbinectedine. I know that's not how the study was done. I know it is with Atezo. So level one evidence per NCCN is Atezo with Lurbi. But from everyday clinical practice, I don't think I have an objection if somebody's on Durva to go on to receive Durva with Lurbi. Question, second question, I think it was, you know, how long do you continue this? As Anne pointed out, on the original checkpoint inhibitor trial, we were told to continue the checkpoint inhibitor until disease progression or unacceptable toxicity. And I think to some extent that can hold in this setting also, understanding that, again, with the addition of lurbinectedine, there might be more side effects as we went over the data that I just presented. So there might be a point where you want to discontinue one drug versus the other, depending on the toxicities. For example, if I see pneumonitis or hepatitis or pancreatitis or any other typical symptoms and side effects associated with a checkpoint inhibitor, that would prompt me to stop and not continue. MRD is an interesting question. I still firmly believe that there will be a role for MRD assay and introduction into standard practice, but I would consider that as a research tool at the time of this discussion. And I'm hoping that as we sort of refine our approach in identifying better tests, we can use MRD. But I'm not willing to say that I will use an assay on an everyday clinical practice to decide whether someone should come off of a treatment or continue, because we just don't have that evidence. And quite frankly, I don't think I trust any of the MRD assays right now to the extent where I feel comfortable saying, based on the result of this test, you should or should not continue with treatment.
Anne, anything you want to add to that? How long would you keep the Lurbi going, Anne?
I think that's going to be, you know, as long as they can tolerate it. I think that, you know, definitely, I've had patients on 6 to 8 months of lurbinectedine done well, one for longer than a year. So I think that they can keep on going as long as their performance status is good and they're tolerating it, keep on going.
So let's take a look at this survey. I'll show you a number of results and then get what your thoughts are. Starting out here with a 65-year-old patient, extensive stage disease, no CNS involvement. Maybe because they're thinking about maintenance Lurbi. Now, in the past, we would see 50-50 split. Now you see more people saying Atezo as the IO. And we asked people, do they think there's a difference between the IOs? Everybody agrees with what Haas just said, that theoretically, you would expect them to have similar benefits and risks, but of course, we do see the approval with Atezo. And then we asked about this scenario, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. A patient who got platinum etoposide and radiation therapy with durvalumab consolidation 2 years previously, now with metastatic disease. And again, you see same first-line approaches, at least before we get to the maintenance story. 6 months, though, they say, torlatimab. So again, any thoughts about the patients with prior treatment and prior IO and chemo for limited stage disease?
Yeah, I think this is a great question that's really starting to come up. You know, if a patient's been off of any therapy, the durvalumab finished it a year or 2 years ago, then I am number one, definitely going to re-biopsy that to make sure that it's recurrent small cell. But I would consider using the platinum doublet as a tool. I think that, you know, we have more tools than we did, but we still have a limited number of active tools for our patients. If it's 6 months or less, I would be thinking about tarlatamab.
Anything you want to add to that, Haas?
Oh, I'd like to emphasize, re-biopsying somebody who's been 2 years out from treatment just to make sure that you're dealing with the same disease. But I agree with Anne. Again, we don't have good data on this, but 6 months is sort of the cutoff we have landed on. If it's been less than 6 months, I think I switch agents. If it's 6 months or higher or longer, then I'm willing to reconsider and do the additional chemo IO in this patient population.
So, of course, we asked about the issue of maintenance therapy. I thought the answers were kind of interesting here. So here we say the patient had a CR to atezo and chemotherapy. And actually, people are kind of split. More people saying they would use LERB, but quite a few saying atezo alone. If we say the patient had a partial response, we see more people now thinking about LERB. But we also said suppose they had a partial response, but they had to have multiple dose reductions, now less LERB. And any thoughts?
I think if you have a partial response, you know, that used to be the situation where we might even think about giving another two cycles of chemo. So, you know, this is switch chemo, but I think that the same concept that, boy, I'd really like to have a little bit more of a response. So I think that probably is why the LERB atezo is higher in that population.
So what about this situation? Actually, similar to one of your cases here, a patient who had asymptomatic brain metastasis as well as extensive systemic disease. And so the question is, again, in addition to whether or not they get radiation therapy to the brain or SRS, et cetera, what about LERB in the presence of brain mets? And again, it kind of looks like the same numbers we saw with or without brain mets. Does that affect your approach to maintenance LERB, Haas, brain mets?
Not necessarily, but I'm more on the camp of using LERB and atezo, as we discussed it earlier, partially because I'm biased towards the IMforte study, and I think it does add a little something. But again, it has to do with the tolerability of the regimen and how well the patient can tolerate these regimens and how well they've done with everything else. But in general, I'm in agreement with doing the maintenance atezo LERB in this setting and addressing the brain as a separate issue.
So, Ann, I don't know, just flashing to San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium in December, we had docs presenting cases by video. We actually had a 103-year-old patient that was presented.
Wow.
Who wanted to be treated, was treated, and has successfully treated and is walking around taking care of herself. But anyhow, I never thought to ask that. But we did ask in the survey about 85-year-old. And, you hear the term, Ann, very elderly. You know, people talk about age as just a number. And we said, you know, this patient's a little frail, as many 85 years old, PS of 1. And still, we see 20% of the general oncologists here say they would consider or recommend LERB. You know, I think another thing that comes up all the time in oncology is involving the patient in the decision. And this 103-year-old lady, the woman wanted to be treated. And so I think that needs to be taken into consideration. But Anne, we do see a lot of very elderly patients with small cell. How do you approach the issue of maintenance there?
I think that you have to see how they did with the treatment and what their performance status is. I think the issue with elderly, whereas I absolutely think they should be treated and offered and you should have that to share decision making, they often have less reserve if they have issues that come up. And so I would err on the side of being more conservative for that particular patient if they're really frail and giving immunotherapy and saying, you know, we still have the option of doing of treating of using lurbinectedin in the second line setting.
So we also asked these docs what their experiences with LERB or maintenance with LERB. Of course, it was used quite a bit for second line therapy for a while now. And myelosuppression was brought up, fatigue, GI toxicity. Haas, can you provide a little bit more of a flavor of what you see? And also, one of your patients, you use trilaciclib, and I'm curious to what extent you're using that nowadays.
So let me answer that question first. I'm beginning to introduce it more and more in my induction phase with my patients, just because carbotopicide, again, as everybody on the call knows, is associated with significant myelosuppression. It's one of the reasons where we have dose reductions and dose delays, and administration of chemo can be delayed because of this. So with the use of trilaciclib, I've been able to avoid some of the typical dose delays and dose reductions that we see with this. So again, I'm a sort of a newcomer to it, but I'm becoming more and more comfortable with the addition of trilaciclib. I don't use it in the maintenance setting. It is only with the induction where the approval is. So I've been happy with that. If I don't use trilaciclib, I definitely use prophylactic G-CSF in patients with additional comorbidities. For example, the patient, the second case I presented with heart failure, COPD, and a number of other reasons. And again, a lot of the guidelines are in agreement and in alignment with frontline use of growth factors in this setting. That's how I've sort of introduced the trilaciclib into my everyday practice. I think it was the second part to your question.
Yeah, the other toxicities that you observe. Yeah. Fatigue was mentioned. What do you see? GI toxicity?
No, actually, what I see most commonly is fatigue. We do have myelosuppression. I do have to do dose reductions. That definitely is something that I see. But to me, I think the fatigue is more pronounced, and it might be actually a little bit more than what we saw in the actual clinical trial. So when you talk to patients, I think you get a sense that there's definitely additional fatigue that lasts a little bit longer in this patient population in the maintenance setting. So that's the one thing that has led me to wanting to hold the treatment for somebody who's had significant fatigue. So beyond that, and with the exception of that, the cardiovascular issue that I present, I haven't really seen anything beyond and above what our colleagues have reported and what we saw in the clinical trials.
So, Anne, a very common question we got in the survey, we actually asked in the survey, which is, do people use prophylactic G-CSF in patients who are getting a atezolizumab as maintenance therapy? And you can see half the people in the survey said, yes, that's what they do. And then about a quarter said they do for select patients. Carlos in the chat room wants to know, do you do dose reduction of LURB-B, and how do you do that, and what do you do it for? Any comments about G-CSF and dose reduction of LURB-B, Anne?
I think you have the benefit of seeing how they did with the induction chemo, and if they really dropped their counts and required G, then I would continue it. If they didn't need it, or it seemed like that was, they were doing fine, then I might potentially stop it. But I think, I'd err on the side of continuing. I think that these patients, their marrow gets beat up.
All right, we're going to move on now. And in a few minutes, Anne's going to talk about sort of what's coming up soon. Of course, everybody wants to know where tarlatamab is going to end up landing. But first, again, a couple more cases, again, getting into practical patient care. And you've got a 72-year-old never smoker, which I'm not sure I've seen any of before, but maybe you have. Can you tell us about this patient?
Yeah. So it 72-year-old never smoker, and she had a remote history of melanoma that was removed, had DVT on anticoagulation, and she presented in the summer with a right upper lobe lesion. You can see that right there. She had bulky mediastinal and a right supraclavicular lymph node and widespread metastases, including in the liver, pancreas, and the bone lesions. You can see her right arm over there as well. She had a brain MRI that showed a bone lesion, no brain mets, and the biopsy showed small cell. And it is part of NCCN guidelines that if you have a never smoker, to do NGS sequencing on these patients, because you can sometimes see an EGFR mutation, and I actually have had that in the past. She did not have a targetable mutation where you might add OC to the chemo. She had the expected P53 and RB1 mutations, and she was treated with chemo, atezo, 4 cycles and induction, and had a really good response, and still had a great PS of 1. So these patients, I think are really great clinical trial candidates. We're really trying to see how we can augment and that tail of the curve, as we talked about at the beginning. She was not eligible. We talked about being aggressive. She wanted to do LURB-B, and so she's going to start this month very soon, I think next week.
So before Haas comments on the case, yeah. I'm just kind of curious. So you actually had a patient with real small cell who had an EGFR tumor mutation. Did the patient respond to osimertinib?
The patient was treated with OC plus chemo and did have a very good response. We did not treat her with IO, but continued her on osimertinib maintenance.
Amazing. Haas, any comments about this case? 72 is kind of getting in the immediate, not very old, not very young. How do you think through, again, your discussions with patients and any comments about this case, particularly with the non-smoking aspect?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I've seen two or three cases of never smoker small cell, usually in younger patients. And unfortunately, both of my patients in the past year and a half have been females, or maybe 2 years. So it's a rare phenomenon. I think Dr. Rudin's group in New York put some case series together and did additional molecular and other testing. It is a little bit of a different biology. It's a little bit of a different disease. And I absolutely agree with the NGS testing, just in case that an EGFR is found, because as you heard from Anne, the treatment could be quite effective. But to me, this is a more difficult disease to treat. And I think, unfortunately, the outcomes are not as good with the standard treatment. So I think this would be a case where I would look for clinical trials to see if I can enroll the patient on something that can be a little bit more meaningful. But in the absence of trials, I would do exactly what Anne had suggested, standard chemo plus immunotherapy, and then consider the lorbinectedine at the back end.
So, Anne, before you present your second case, a couple of questions from the chat room. I'll keep going with you, Haas. This interesting thought from Venue. Do you think these non-smokers maybe had secondary exposure from secondhand smoke? And also, Zinn and then wants to know, do you routinely do NGS in patients with small cell?
I don't routinely do NGS, but we do have a sort of an in-house translational project where we're beginning to do more of that. So in that context, I'll do it. I will definitely do it in the case of a never smoker, again, as suggested by Anna and on the NCCN guidelines. The difficulty is that, you know, again, with the NGS testing, we're hoping that we can find additional trials or targets that allow us to offer the patient some sort of a clinical trial at the time of progression. Secondhand smoke, we do ask that question, at least I do, if I have somebody who is a never smoker. I don't know if there's data on it, but I would also say that we're beginning to see more and more percentage-wise of patients who are never smokers from other countries when they participate in clinical trials. So if you look at these global trials that we're doing, if you look at the table of patient characteristics, you're beginning to see 10-15% of these patients are never smokers with small cell. So it is definitely a phenomenon that we're beginning to see more. And as to what the etiology is anybody's guess at this point. But secondhand smoke is always a good question, and we do try to ask that if we have the right patient. With a similar scenario as what Anne was presenting.
Interesting, because the Venue who asked that question followed up and said the reason she asked is because she had a never smoker, was not a small cell, who had worked as a bartender. Mm. I don't know whether do people still smoke in bars anymore? But in any event, I think that's kind of, I can imagine, at least in the old days, a fair amount of exposure being a bartender. All right, how about the 75-year-old man, Anne?
So this is a gentleman with a pretty high, a significant smoking history, 50 pack years at least, COPD, and did have in 2019 an early stage squamous cell and had a left upper lobectomy, was cured of that, and then developed limited stage small cell in 2023 and was treated definitively with concurrent chemo rads. With chemo. No Durva at that time, it wasn't yet available. And then he had restaging scans just recently, and this showed the arrow here, new right hilar, posterior mediastinal, also in the abdomen retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy, and a right chest wall lesion. And a biopsy of that did show small cell carcinoma. And so this is a patient where he has a good performance status. He's independent in ADLs, and I know that he's progressed on chemo radiation in the past, so I really wanted to put him on a clinical trial. And this is also some of what I'm going to talk about, the clinical trials that are available. So he consented to the first-line TARLA trial, Delphi 312, was randomized to the standard of care arm and just started this past month.
So, Haas, any comments about the case? If this patient had not been eligible for a clinical trial, how would you likely have managed the patient?
Probably with the standard of care, which is platinum etoposide plus a checkpoint inhibitor, and then, you know, consider down the road whether a patient is candidate for sort of the addition of Lurpee down the road. But I don't think I would have done anything differently than what was presented on Ann's case.
All right. Well, let's take a look at some of the trials that are out there. I'll also be curious what trials you have at your institution. But Ann, can you provide us with sort of an overview of where things are heading?
Absolutely. Okay. So I'm going to talk about three approaches to improve long-term outcomes. One is using active agents earlier in frontline or maintenance. And we already heard about the IMforte trial. So I'll talk about another maintenance or a couple of maintenance trials. And then the other option is to optimize our frontline therapy with combinations. And we also heard that there's attrition, even when you go to, in the IMforte trial, at the beginning of the trial, 25% we're in shape to go on to maintenance. So let's move it earlier and add to the current first-line therapy. That's the additive approach. And then the other approach that I'll talk about are trials that replace some components of the frontline therapy with alternatives. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about how we can leverage our understanding of small cell biology and heterogeneity to target and the use of biomarkers to target therapy. So these are the trials I'm going to talk about, selected first-line or maintenance trial. The first one is a maintenance trial with tarlatamab, Delphi 305. And then these next two trials are frontline therapies where, again, you're adding something, either tarlatamab in Delphi 312 or, in this case, the TIGOS trial, a tigotatug. Which I'll tell you what the mechanism of that. And then I'll also talk about three trials where we're replacing one of the components. In these first two trials, the Rosetta Lung, and this next trial, we're replacing the checkpoint inhibitor with a bispecific PD-1 VEGF. And then in the last trial over here, says Anne, not named for me, but it has my name, we're talking about actually removing the platinum doublet, which blows my mind. Okay, so let's start out with the maintenance piece of it. This is actually, there is some data, and this was presented at World Lung. This is the phase 1b trial presented by Kelly Paulson, and they looked at, this is shown here, 88 patients, almost half of them had TARLA plus atezo, and the other had TARLA plus durva. And what is amazing from this trial is look at the median overall survival here. It's 25 months, right? So that's beating any of the numbers that we've seen so far. It was a manageable safety profile, and these findings support the ongoing phase 3 Delphi 305 maintenance study, which has already finished accrual. And so we'll know probably within the next year to 2 years what our maintenance strategy will be. And I suspect that it will be including tarlatamab. Okay, so the next additive approach, this is the TIGOS trial. Okay, so using a tigotatug, and this is an antibody that basically targets the fucosal GM1 antigen, okay? And the idea here is that not only are you getting your T-cell ADCC, but then you're also having the addition of innate immune responses, such as complement-dependent cytotoxicity and phagocytosis. And so this trial looks at atigo and nevo versus atezo, and the phase 1-2 study showed that the overall response rate was 40%. The randomized phase 2 actually showed overall survival of 15.6 months, and so we're waiting for the phase 3. Okay. So now let's talk about the replacement strategy. So replacing a checkpoint inhibitor with a bispecific that targets PD-L1, PD-1 axis, as well as VEGF. This is the BioNTech compound, and you can see the overall response rates here, almost 90%, 80 to 90%, and the deep responses that happen quickly. So that phase three is ongoing. And here's another option for that same approach. And it uses a different antibody that has, it's tetravalent, which each arm can engage both targets. And so that one is also ongoing. Okay, so the last one that I had talked about uses an antibody drug conjugate and is, you can see this is the SEZ6-1 ADC, and the overall response rate was about 56%. But if you looked in the second line, it was 80%, and it was also effective against brain mets. So using this data, this phase two trial is going to randomize first-line patients to this ADC plus IO versus a platinum doublet. And so that's a platinum-free option for our patients. Amazing. Lastly, I will mention the trial that I'm actually national chair on. This is through the cooperative groups, and this takes patients 800 some, and during induction, we're going to test the tissue for which subtype the patient has and the Schlafen-11 status, and based on that, we're going to randomize the patient to a biomarker-directed therapy plus Durva versus Durva alone. So we're going to learn a lot from this, including it's the first trial testing subtypes, a targeted therapy. It's going to be precision medicine, and hopefully tissue will no longer be the issue, and a lot of patients will have access to novel therapeutic combinations through the cooperative group networks. And I think that is my last slide. So lots to look forward to.
That trial that you're running there with the biomarker approach, the PRISM study, is fascinating. Can you just comment a little bit more about the subtypes and what the difference is? Is there any phenotypic difference? I certainly haven't seen very much about this. Can you kind of explain it to us?
Right. So the short version is that the MD Anderson folks, Carl Gay and Lauren Byers, looked at the IMpower 133 trial with atezo, and they did unsupervised analysis, and they saw four subtypes that came out, three of which were characterized by upregulation of transcriptional factors ASCL1, NeuroD1, and POU2F3, and the third one was like a triple negative. It didn't have transcription factors overexpressed, but it did have inflammatory checkpoints. And what they found is that subtype I did the best with atezo, and that benefit, the overall survival of 18 months, went away in the placebo arm. So the idea here is that there are subtypes, and we can start to understand which ones do better. The subtype P actually has a relatively poor prognosis. So there are differences there. I don't think I have time to get into all of this, but we definitely have a rationale for the treatments that we're choosing.
Sounds like we do a whole another webinar just on this. So one final question, getting back to you, Haas. Again, one of the most common questions we got, we could spend a lot of time talking about it, is the question of outpatient tarlatamab. Where do we stand with that? What do we see in terms of CRS with tarlatamab? When I first heard about it, I'm like, wow, this is going to be interesting. It turns out maybe it's not as difficult as I thought it was going to be, but you tell me.
Well, again, we participated in the phase one development of tarlatamab, so we've had a little bit more of an experience from an institutional point of view. And so far, I have to tell you, at least at Fox Chase, we're sticking to the label, meaning that the first couple of doses of the drug, the patients are admitted for observation. But we know that our colleagues in leukemia and lymphoma have had experiences with these drugs, and we're learning from them as to how to do more of an outpatient management. So much like many other institutions, we're beginning to put our own protocol together to observe patients as opposed to admit them unless there's an obvious need for admission, to try to move this more into an outpatient setting. And I think some of the newer studies with tarlatamab are going to introduce this idea of sort of closer observation as opposed to required admission for follow-up. the CRS events are real. It happens, and you have to monitor these patients. But the majority of these, again, as reported on many of the studies, are of grade 1 and 2 nature, so they're very much manageable. That doesn't mean that grade 3 toxicities cannot happen. It does not mean that ICANS cannot happen. We have definitely seen those cases. But majority of these CRS events have been very much manageable with standard IV fluids and steroids and things of that nature. But again, you know, I want to make sure that you know, patients are treated in an institution where you have access to you know, an ICU level care if needed. Because again, even though the rates are low, grade 3 toxicities can happen. So the management is becoming very algorithmic and standardized. So for our in-house, we have a very algorithmic approach as to how to identify and treat CRS. This way, everybody who comes in contact with the patient can easily access the algorithm and manage the patients appropriately. But again, I'm hoping that pretty soon we'll be able to manage most of these patients in an outpatient setting as opposed to the required hospitalization.
So, of course, the good news is general medical oncologists already are deep into CD3 bispecifics and multiple myeloma and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So we just sort of move this one. It sounds like maybe similar principles in many ways. So, Ann and Haas, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Ann. Thanks, Haas. Great to work with you.
Thank you.